It's the Jesus vs. Santa edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Jesus or Santa? What is the true meaning for the season? Why it's better to be a non-believer than a believer at Christmas? A flashback with Christmas reality check, humanism and Christmas, and we end the show with a cavalcade of unusual Christmas music. Let's begin episode 279.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is actually an anti-wine. This week, on the precipice of Christmas, I thought I would take a poke at why it's better to be an atheist at Christmas than to be religious. You see, when you're a Christian, or Jewish for that matter, I mean if you swap Christmas for Hanukkah you kinda get in the same spot, there are a lot of restrictions with regards to timing. I mean when you say you want to be home for Christmas, well that means December 25th. You have to deal with the stampede of other churchers who have ensured finding a flight will not only be difficult, but airlines know they can charge a premium because, well, you have to take that Christmas flight. And there's no relief for those who choose to drive because again, under the date restrictions, the days before Christmas are ensured to see the biggest traffic jams of the year. Not so for those of us who are non-believers in that invisible man in the sky. We could stay home for Christmas, neither in lamentation or guilt. When we wish to visit family, we can do so in, what's that term? The off-season. That is when you not only get your choice of flight and seat, but often the prices are slashed because, well, it's the off-season. Then, of course, the truly religious must contend with hours of kneeling, standing, singing, reciting, and sitting while the seemingly endless masses are conducted, as in praying and listening to some preachy guy tell you the pros and cons of obeying the omnificent, farcical dude in the cloud. Which, of course, makes us atheists wonder how the religious can ever really feel safe. I mean, because of the rules the followers are supposed to follow, well, they're made up and arbitrary, with no consistent interpretation. For reference, look in your phone book. Actually, do we even have phone books anymore? Okay, well then, Google churches in your local area, and you will likely find a deluge of different denominations, none agreeing on what the rules are for getting into heaven or hell. You never are really certain whether you're on the right team, so to speak. While they're praying, we atheists get to enjoy that select bottle of port we've been saving, while watching a good movie or listening to some music. Things we don't have time to do, but now, because thanks to the reason for the season, need I say more? And what better time than Christmas Eve to have that Lord of the Rings marathon, including your recently illegally downloaded copy of Hobbit Part 3. It's your night, and the next day, it's free for you to enjoy. Of course, those of us who have children may have to face a quandary most devout Christians do not have to worry about, Santa Claus. At this point, we atheists find ourselves in the same boat as most fundamentalists of Christians, because they see Santa Claus as a corruption by Satan, a wavering away from the true meaning of Christmas. Well, I for one never worry about the true meaning, but do you, on the one hand, reject Christmas because it's focused around an imaginary Jesus slash God, and yet accept the equally imaginary Santa Claus? And not that I have any issue with Santa being imaginary, but to children, well, that can be a tad complicated. Let me restate that. As good skeptical people, we want to raise children in the real world. With respect to God, we choose not to teach children that God is real because, well, it's not true. He's just made up. So how could we then take them to see Santa Claus at the mall, do the whole naughty or nice thing, and not be a hypocrite? Now, I've had people ask me, well, more tell me, that I can't celebrate Christmas because I'm an atheist. And to that I say, bollocks. And don't worry, this will tie into Santa's dilemma later. Don't think I'm leaving the jolly old man stranded. So it is true, Christmas began as a pagan festival of life, dating back at least to the Saturnalia, an ancient Roman ritual in honor of the deity Saturn, The holiday included sacrifices at the altar, banquets that were followed by gift-giving and merriment. Even the slaves were provided for. But of course, our Christmas is supposed to be all about baby Jesus and Mary and the whole virgin birth thing. Is it rape if God does it? Anyway, I do get sidetracked. Again, the Jesus thing was the way Christmas, as we know it, got its start. But over time, it has lost a fair amount of its churchiness. That is, and this is, where Santa Claus returns. The season is now seen as a time of gift-giving, showing a little extra kindness to those less well-off and those in need. It is a time, perhaps an opportunity, to show those in our lives that are important to us just how we truly feel. When I think of Christmas, I think about the homeless enjoying an extra special meal. The one time of year they, the unseen, ignored, and subjugated, can pretend society has not forgotten them. This is the one time of year beyond all others their presence is acknowledged and actually do count. That they're human, irrespective of how, sadly, we tend to treat them the rest of the year. It gives us an excuse to show, in deed or gift, to all those people who make our lives better, that we have noticed them and that their presence is valued. It makes me feel sad that we choose as a society to segregate out just one special time of the year to show just how human, how compassionate, how saintly, virtuous we can be it a month, a week, or even just a single day. If only we could spread this goodwill and caring throughout the entire year, how better we would be, the world would be. But I, at this time of year, I'm truly thankful at least we do have a Christmas time where we are allowed to be as good as we can truly be. And this is where I rescue Santa. You see, he knows if you've been good or bad, so you better be good, or no presents. And this is something kids carry with them all year long, and well, it makes them better people. They always try and think, should I have done this? Should I try to do the good thing? Will Santa reward me if I do niceness to other people? And sure, if you're bad, you may get a coal in your stocking, but compared to God's reaction, and eternity burning in hell, well, Santa's the keeper. And unlike Jesus, we do grow out of it. I think of Santa as sort of training wheels for compassion, something we can jettison when we come of age and where we understand that being good and kind is its own reward. So, Merry Christmas to some and Happy Holidays to all. We'll return with some of the classic Radio Free Thinker Christmas segments after this break.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Listener's note. When this was recorded, I was suffering a pretty bad cold at the time, so my voice sounds a little weird, and we were having a bit of trouble with the mic, so if it sounds a little bit more echoey than normal, my humblest apologies, but I hope you enjoy this segment. So, let's start off with some really important questions that come up in the Christmas season. Is Christmas the birth of Jesus? Well, the short answer is no. First, the tradition of Christianity does not actually celebrate births, but celebrates death, or, quote, you know, the passing on to a better place. The whole tenet of Christianity is that it doesn't really matter where you were born or what you have done with your life, but that you right here and now sort of give your life over to Jesus or God or both, depending on your theology, which one works. This is why Easter is sort of the Super Bowl, Grey Cup, and World Series all wrapped up into one of the Catholic season.
Well, doesn't that really involve a birth and a death?
Easter? No, Easter is resurrection. So well, you die.
That's sort of birth.
Well, it's the born again part. And actually, that is key.
to the whole point that your initial birth is irrelevant to the whole sort of Christian mythos. So, yeah. And, of course, the second part, let's assume that Christmas is about the birth of Jesus originally.
Consider it assumed.
No one actually knows when he was born. Or, I mean, technically, we don't even know sort of if he was born. Because, I mean, he's supposed to be divine. And it's not unheard of in mythical sort of cycles for a entity to become sort of full-grown adult and just sort of appear on the scene. Now, of course, it is mentioned in two Gospels about his birth. And, of course, only the two Gospels. It's rather sort of the hidden childhood of Christ. And, of course, these two stories tell conflicting events. So they don't actually even agree in what they say themselves. And there's actually no credible third-party evidence to corroborate either one of the incidences. Although, of course, there have been numerous attempts and analysis sort of to post hoc and shoehorn in, you know, oh, this is probably the year he was born because there might have been a census and that sort of thing. But even if we go with that, the date itself is rather hit and miss. And, of course, the elephants in the room are, I guess it would be the reindeer in the room.
See, I was going to go donkey, but okay.
Okay. And most of our listeners will probably know this, is December 25th, plus or minus a few days, is one of the most popular seasons for pagan celebrations, be it the winter solstice, Roman celebrations of the god of agriculture. Yeah, alcohol is wrong. That's a whole other thing. Saturnalius Festival. And, of course, the cult of Mithra's most holy day coincidentally happens to fall on the 25th of December. One of the geniuses of the early church leaders wasn't the fact, I mean, they didn't sit there and say, well, let's destroy these other competing religions. Let's get rid of all of their holy places, all of the things. What they did is they co-opted them. They said, well, okay, you have this big festival. Great, you know, and let's say it's winter solstice. So the evil demon of darkness is finally defeated on this day by the joyousness of the light.
And you celebrate with cookies.
Right, raw cookie dough. But, of course, what the Christians did, instead of sitting and saying, okay, we're going to ban the winter solstice festival. No, no. What they would say is they say, well, instead of saying that it was like, you know, darkness, let's say it was like Satan and evil. And that the light that destroys the evil is like our Jesus, like our God, defeating, you know, the power of darkness and bringing on the light. Forgive me.
Don is still
recovering.
Not so much on his last legs anymore, but still a little bit under the weather.
But the point being, to go back to our story, is their ability to sort of co-opt these sort of pagan festivals and recast them in sort of a veneer of Christianity, which is really where you kind of get the whole Christmas is the birth of Jesus. It's just a recasting of an old one. Thus, in the 4th century, the Christian church began to actually officially celebrate Jesus' birthday in the middle of all this sort of pagan festivals, just casting into a theological light. So thus, things like burning of candles to hold back the darkness of the day becomes recast of the eternal warmth of God's love. The Christmas tree goes from being, you know, the everlasting life of Germanic tribes to become becomes adorned with apples and sort of becomes the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, and all these just things become recast. An interesting thing I didn't know, but doing my research, is that John the Baptist, the person who converted Jesus to Christianity,
yes,
and a very poor manipulation of the work, his birthday is set at the summer solstice.
How convenient. There is sort of,
yeah, it's an interesting tat for tit, tit for tat. So that's with that. Now, of course, another big landmark about Christmas is the Christmas tree. Where did the Christmas tree come from? I know, the forest. But if a Christmas tree falls in the forest, does it have presents?
That's a nice pun.
Thank you.
But the song O Tannenbaum leads me to believe it's of German origin.
Largely, yes. Most research places the Christmas tree to Northern Europe. During the dark days of winter, the Celtic people, Germanic people, you can cast them however you wish, celebrated the winter solstice as sort of the time when summer was on its way back, right? It was like,
I still celebrate that, man. Like, man, the mornings are going to start happening a little bit earlier next week, and the afternoons a little bit late. I'm stoked.
yay, winter solstice.
Spring in the tree.
Yeah. So in order to sort of remind people about the good times ahead, they would go out and they would cut down an evergreen and place it as a centerpiece sort of their activities. The evergreen, of course, being the only sort of green tree left in the middle of winter, was sort of the sign of unending life and striving through the dark days of winter.
Well, I hope that they remembered to have a tree stand full of water, or else A, tree's going to fall over, and B, that tree is not going to be green for that long.
True. But ironically enough, there is points to that as well. So another thing that was actually quite popular are wreaths of pines, you know, pine wreaths that you get there, right? Which, of course, are often hung up on doors and windows and all that to sort of keep off the evil spirits of winter. Because, again, we're talking about the middle of winter. Foodstuffs are beginning to come quite short.
Mm-hmm.
People are beginning to die from cold. They're beginning to die from starvation. And this whole idea of any life force that can hold off this evilness. And, of course, the Christians at first tried hard to get rid of this aspect. Because to them, worshipping a tree was just pure paganism and not a very good thing. But at some point, again, the Christian fathers sort of said, hey, we ain't going to win this one. This is just too deep-rooted. So we'll just recast it.
Deep-rooted.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm here all week. So they essentially attempted to recast it in a more Christian theme. Now, of course, this still remained a relatively Germanic sort of thing, right? It never really caught on big in the rest of the Christian world until, of course, Queen Victoria, who, as we all know, was a very good German.
Trendsetter.
Yeah, and her husband, of course, Prince Albert. They celebrated Christmas with a Christmas tree. It was part of their sort of cultural heritage. And in 1841, there was an illustration of the Queen with her Christmas tree. And, of course, everyone wanted to be like the Queen at that time. Monarchy, very, very popular in England at the time. And that's where, boom, he just had this tremendous growth in the whole Christmas tree as a part of the Christmas tradition. Before then, it was not really that common outside of, again, the Nordic sort of...
Which, before safe lighted lights, was a pretty good idea because they had real flames on the trees, which is kind of dangerous.
Well, actually, you see, that was another thing, though. You had mentioned about how it dries out and that sort of thing, right?
True that.
Right. Well, but part of that was also built into the whole celebration. Because, one, you would burn the logs, the Christmas tree, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would provide you warmth. It would provide you light. And you'd have this nice pine scent. And you may or may not know, because you growing up in a very hygienic family. I grew up in a very hygienic family. But I have read places that if you get a lot of people cramped up in a single house, a longhouse type thing, with very poor hygienic conditions, not much ventilation, no one allowed to leave because it's too cold outside, a certain odor will start to permeate the building. So the burning of pine would help remove that sort of scent.
It's like incense.
Exactly.
Or,
exactly.
You know, a little Glade flameless candle with extra flame.
Yeah, I was going to say with extra heavy duty flame, but... But again, so I mean, there was a lot of things, but again, co-opted, and it's become part of our tradition, and really not much of the Christian tradition, even by today's fundamentalist standards. It's just sort of decorations.
Yeah.
Which is why it's funny when a lot of the fundamentalists complain about, well, they put up a Christmas tree in Central Park, or they won't put up one because it's considered to be a Christian symbol, when it's not really.
Mm.
But of course, most of the fundamentalists get upset about nativity scenes and them being denied. So then I thought, hey, where did the nativity scene come from?
And, Bethlehem. Everybody knows that.
You would think. Seen by many, like say, fundamentalist Christians as probably the most iconic Christmas image, the nativity scene is Jesus in a manger surrounded by Mary and Joseph and some animals and the wise men. And we've all kind of seen it at one point or another.
You betcha.
Those of us less fortunate may have had to reenact it in school at some point or another.
You had to play the baby Jesus, didn't you?
Yeah, no. But I grew up in a time when church and state wasn't quite so separate as it is now. But apparently the origin of the nativity scene, or more historically, the nativity crib, traces back to the 13th century when St. Francis of Assisi, in an attempt to make his last Christmas on earth one to remember, created the major scene sans Jesus. So there was no Jesus in the original. He just sort of created where everything happened.
So everyone was just staring at an empty manger?
Essentially. But, of course, now this is apocryphal. as Francis began to chant the Holy Gospel, quote-unquote, the Babe of Bethlehem appeared. Francis hugged the child, and of course, poof, the child disappeared, and everyone felt quite holy. This visit of the baby Jesus, of course, made quite popular this sort of idea of, you know, having the manger, and Jesus might appear to you, right? And of course, props eventually began to stand in for what essentially was a pantomime by Francis Assisi. He was sort of doing a play with the manger sort of props and that.
My question is, why would you ever want to be visited by a baby Jesus? Like, if you're going to be visited by Jesus, who during his lifetime, as far as, you know, what's commonly attributed to him saying, he had some wise things to say, but, like, would you want to be visited by a baby Einstein? No, you'd want to be visited by Einstein.
Oh, but you have to remember the Christian ethos here. Baby Jesus was the epitome of purity. Because, I mean, we remember teenage Jesus had evil thoughts. And then the later Jesus...
Oh, teenage Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. And we remember that, you know, young adult Jesus had dalliances with hookers. Let us not forget.
Hookers are people, too.
Yes. God, I can't remember her name right now. Not my hooker, his hooker. you only hear it first. So anyhow, again, originally done sort of as a pantomime, you know, with real people and all that. Soon the living people were replaced by props. And by the 16th century, it was actually deemed heretical to perform the nativity scene because there were so many sort of mystic overtones. You know, you were kind of trying to elicit the spirit of Jesus, and that kind of struck them as more magical. However, German immigrants are credited with reviving the pantomime version when they came back to America, and that's where we kind of have our traditional vision of the pantomime. The nativity scene with all the little props and all that. Mm-hmm. So, not really a ancient tradition.
Nor one that was always endorsed.
No, exactly. You know, it's very bizarre. And speaking of not being endorsed, you know what's another popular thing at Christmas?
I know lots of popular things at Christmas. Have I mentioned cookies?
You did. And which are better, cookies you get or cookies you give?
Awesome. I don't want to offend any of my baking friends.
Okay. Well, gift-giving is one of the big things at Christmas time.
True.
And ironically enough, if you ignore the idea of Christmas, but this time of year, it is probably the oldest and truest part of the tradition. It has its actual roots in the Roman celebration of Saturnalia, where feasting, orgies, and gift-giving were preeminent.
Sounds like Christmas to me.
Similarly, during the solstice festival, it was quite common for people to gather and exchange gifts, or perhaps more accurately, to sort of pool their resources in lean times and offer gifts to the sun. Please come back. We miss you, that sort of thing. So, again, you know, it seems quite a very long-lasting, and actually, in many ways, the real root of Christmas has nothing to do with, you know, real Christianity or anything, but this idea of giving to others as sort of a nice gesture to do, as sort of a thank you.
So are we saying that Christmas really is about Santa Claus?
Well, we'll talk about Santa later, but yes, it is sort of...
More about gift-giving and gift-centric than Jesus-centric?
Exactly. In fact, the church tolerated this tradition until the Protestant Reformation, when, most notably in England, Christmas was outlawed.
Gasp.
Yeah, well, this was sort of the first modern attempt to sort of overlook the true origins of Christmas and to sort of restore the false but reason for the season. Of course, by the time the Victorians came around, you know, 19th century, most of the religious aspect of Christmas had actually gone. I mean, in Victorian England, religion was sort of, it was there, but it was not really the reason for the season. Things like Charles Dickinson and his A Christmas Carol and "Twas the Night Before Christmas," which was an American version of a Christmas poem sort of thing, had replaced Jesus and everything and all that, and had replaced it with this idea of charity and giving to others and to be with family and to be good to your fellow man. And those had sort of become the dominant themes. So, you had mentioned this funny, jolly old fellow.
I had.
Where did Satan, I mean Santa, what's he got to do with Christmas? The origins of Santa is far from the North Pole. Most people attribute Santa to be St. Nicholas, who was a 4th century bishop, famous for his generosity, afforded to him, of course, because of inheritance, not because he was a good person, but he had good parents. And, of course, being a bishopric, you get lots of money being a bishopric. It's one of the perks of the job.
So are you saying that you don't get to get credit for having a good personality if someone gave it to you by raising you right?
Yes. I don't think that's quite what I said.
You have to be born by horrible parents and then turn out to be a good person?
No, I'm saying that if you are gifted with a lot of money at birth, it's much easier for you to be a generous soul.
Yes. No, easier, yes. You said he was generous not because he just was, but because his parents raised him right.
Did I mention he lived in Turkey?
No. Oh, my goodness. Really?
Nowhere near the North Pole. The late Bishop Nicholas became a saint largely thanks to his bones. Apparently, his earthly remains oozed an oily substance that was purported to have miraculous healing powers. He is also he's also credited in ghostly form from saving a little boy from Arab raiders in Turkey, and this all became part of his sort of mythos and why he became a saint. And of course, in another made-up story, he is believed to have overheard. And again, I love the context of these things if you pull them apart. So, story goes, St. Nicholas was listening to a father talking about how he would, marry off his three daughters because he was too poor to afford a dowry to make them desirable wives, and thus forcing the father to sell the daughters into prostitution. Now, of course, I sit there and I say, well, that doesn't sound quite right, because I'm sure there were a lot of poor people who didn't sell their daughters into prostitution and just married them off to the banker, or, well, not banker, but to someone else. But anyhow, having overheard this conversation, St. Nicholas, waiting till night because he wanted to be anonymous, threw in through the window of this father 3 bags of gold so they have a proper dowry. And these, coincidentally, landed in socks that were drying by the fireplace of each daughter. Ergo, why we put socks up at Christmas to get Christmas gifts. In a more gruesome story, and again, part of the whole why St. Nicholas is the patron saint of prostitutes in the first case.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the patron saint of children and why we associate him mostly with children. Ready for a gruesome story?
Always.
Apparently, St. Nicholas was traveling and stopped at an inn one day. In the inn, for a good piece of gold, the innkeeper offered Nick some meat. Now, of course, Nick thought this was kind of odd because it was in the middle of a famine and meat was kind of hard to come by. In fact, no one had had meat for months. So his little suspicious mind went down and he checked out the inn's basement, being a good detective. And down there he found 3 dead boys who were being pickled and the source of the meat that the innkeeper was serving. Being, of course, the good, kind-hearted person, Nicholas resurrected the 3 boys and ran away in the middle of the night with the boys.
Hmm.
Who knows what happened to the next set of boys that happened to walk by this inn. I guess they needed their own saint. But for these reasons, again, he becomes the patron saint of children. And, of course, that's why he's associated with it.
So are these boys, like, missing pieces?
If you're miraculously healed, I'm sure the pieces just appear.
Oh, good.
He became known through these sort of things for his gift-giving. But, of course, originally, St. Nicholas' feast and the giving of gifts was actually December 6th. But this, of course, competed with other things, and the Christians wanted to have a reason why you should be giving gifts at Christmas to compete with the pagan holidays. So St. Nicholas got wrapped up into Christmas, and why we give Christmas gifts at Christmas is because of St. Nicholas and competing with pagans. Yay! Of course, Santa is a contraction of Santa Claus, which is the Americanization of Sinterklaas, the Dutch term for St. Nicholas. Traditionally a thin fellow, it was not until an illustration of the poem The Night Before Christmas in 1863 by Thomas Nast that Santa became a jolly fat man. And, of course, thanks to Coca-Cola,
he got dressed in red.
Dressed in red, and he is the Santa as we know today, unless you're into claymation, in which case there's a very famous...
See, it's pretty convenient to stick him on the North Pole, though, because kids can't go looking for him.
Unless you're Inuit.
North Pole's pretty high.
You know, they're... Mm-hmm. And, of course, is it the magnetic North Pole or the geographic North Pole?
Maybe it's big enough that it encompasses both.
Could be. So the last thing I wanted to point out, and where we'll end today's discussion on Christmas, is when did Christmas become a holiday? Can you guess? Can you guess? It's become a festival for hundreds of years, but when did it actually become sort of a holiday?
Well, when did we start to get holidays?
Well, that's the
and
thing.
I say we from a Canadian standpoint.
Well, we actually can, ironically enough, since the Protestant Reformation, it was not a holiday of any kind because Christian worship ethics, right? You worked on Christmas Day, and it was just like any other day. You prayed a bit more, but you prayed as much as you did Thursday.
Did you eat any duck?
No.
Oh.
Well, not tonight.
I'm glad we have Christmas now.
But it wasn't actually until 1870 that Christmas became an official day off of work. Well, technically it became a day off of work for bankers, because that's when the official Bankers Holiday Act was passed in England, and we got it through that. Americans passed a similar thing about the same time of year. Of course, labor had to wait a few decades or so before they got a day off on the same thing. But of course, by that point, the religious, as I mentioned, of Christianity had pretty much been expunged. It wasn't a Christian holiday. It was sort of a family holiday. And of course, one of the classic examples, and I love this, was the very first Christmas card, which was, I think, in 1840s. I can't remember now exactly the date, early on. But the very first Christmas card had sort of three panels. And on the left and right, you had sort of these monochrome of giving charity, you know, giving food to the poor, mm-hmm. giving clothing to the, you know, helpless. And right in the middle were a bunch of fat people in color drinking wine and feeding up and just having a hell of a good old time with the little caption saying, a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. So Christmas, a wonderful holiday, but very little to do with Christianity. So I say go out there and put the real reason back in the season. Get drunk.
Get presents.
Give presents. And just be nice to your fellow human being.
Oh, well, that isn't that jolly from you, Don?
Yay!
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
Hello, and we're back. Well, it's a holiday season, a time of year that can create a sense of conflict for atheists, doubly so for the socialist atheist. How can someone partake in a holiday that celebrates the birth of a mythical character? No, not Santa, but Jesus Christ. It's the reason for the season that can seem to be antithetical to the skeptical sensibilities. If one were a true believer, you could get lost in the pomp and ceremony of the time. Take in that fellowship. As an atheist, one can feel like an outsider, not part. Couple that with the claims of a war on Christmas. I mean, granted, that's mainly in the United States, but still. Add into that the annual battles over religious symbols in public lands, the resistance to secular messages at this time of year. Well, it's a time of year that can be a weird combination of frustration and depression. Okay, that's a bit of a bummer. Sorry about that, folks. But maybe I've got it wrong. Join us today in the Radio Freethinker virtual studio is former BC Humanist Association Executive Director Ian Bushfield. Hello and welcome, Ian.
Thanks for having me back, Don.
Okay, you're an atheist. How does the humanist deal with the quandary I just mentioned? Well, maybe I should be a bit more specific. Is Christmas now a religious holiday, or is it something more than that?
I think it just completely depends on who you ask. For some people like myself, I grew up in a secular home, or there's other like secular Christian homes. You know, families that keep a lot of the traditions and ceremonies from the religion of the culture, but they dispense with the orthodoxy, the supernatural, the authority of religion. So my home, and with my family, we do celebrate Christmas, but it's a holiday about family, peace, goodwill, food, presents, just not baby Jesus. Other humanists, they, try to create their own year-end festivals, either around like the winter solstice. Some celebrate Newtonmas. Isaac Newton was born on December 25th. Or there's one called Human Light that a few tried to start. Or the Unitarian Universalist holiday, Chalukya. That was actually invented right here at UBC. But then finally, there's some, what some people might call ardent or angry atheists, like the Center for Inquiry's Tom Flynn. He takes a more critical approach, and he argues that rational humanists shouldn't try to appropriate holidays from the religion, or even host our own. In fact, he's made a point of showing up to work on Christmas Day every year since 1980s. For him, celebrating Christmas with a statutory holiday is just one more facet of religious privilege.
So, groups like the BC Humanist Association, at least from what I understand, have somewhat tried to provide an alternative to sort of the church groups, you know, with regards to the idea of community. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, the BC Humanist Association is a community for those who are good without God. And it's a fairly common trait among our species to crave social interaction, and we try to provide that along with some critical thinking. And, you know, we try to give a voice to the values we all share by advocating for secularism and through our charity work.
So what kind of activities could a devout atheist participate in?
Well, I mean, humanists and atheists have no real dogma or authoritative text that tells us do this, don't do that. So individuals are really free to come up with traditions that are actually meaningful to you or me or themselves. Those of us who come from a culture steeped in Christianity, we may maintain parts of Christmas that we find value in, while those coming from secular Jewish communities might observe Hanukkah, for example. Others might, like I said before, enjoy creating new traditions, or they're like Tom Flynn and they just say bah humbug to the whole thing.
Have you done your Christmas shopping yet?
Most of it. I think I have one more gift to buy.
Excellent. Getting ahead of things. I usually wait till December 24th.
Yep. You know, humanists should almost, at least in Canada, move our holiday back a week so we can take advantage of Boxing Day sales.
Well, you see, if you're Eastern Orthodox, Christmas comes almost a month later, so they've got that covered.
There we go. Let's just celebrate a big holiday on New Year's.
So let's shift gears a little bit. Now, obviously, this holiday has its origins in the pagan festivals. Of course, then it was co-opted by the Christian celebrations. But now we live in a nominally secular society. So what place, if any, do religious symbols have at this time of year in public spaces? You know, governments, malls, schools?
Yeah, I mean, in a secular country, whether it's Canada, the U.S., or Europe, our governments need to be mindful and respect the sort of increasing religious diversity among the population. So governments shouldn't be endorsing, one point of view to the exclusion of others. In the States, the balance has gone sort of to the all-or-nothing limits, where in some cities the traditional nativity displays are now shared with flying spaghetti monsters and trees of reason, where other towns have just completely banned any city-sponsored holiday displays. Malls are a special case, they're private property, so they can technically do whatever they want and celebrate whatever they want, within the limits of the law. They can't turn people away who are the wrong religion. But ideally, they should be aware of the community they're in. So, for example, this morning I was at Oak Ridge Center, and down one hall they had Santa's workshop, and down another hall they had a menorah, sort of reflecting a couple of the communities in that area.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, but where is the Christian one? So the menorah is Jewish, but Santa isn't...
Yeah, I didn't see a nativity scene around there. Maybe it's just, Vancouver's not a very Christian town, I guess.
Maybe not. But speaking of missing things, and maybe I've missed it, or maybe it's not that controversial as it used to be, but I haven't heard of any, like, secular billboards or bus ads this year. Has the atheist lost the war on Christmas?
Almost my favorite phrase of the year, just because the only place you ever really hear about the so-called war on Christmas are right-wing media commentators who are on, like, Fox News, or it's sort of our side mocking people on Fox News talking about a war on Christmas. I don't really know of many atheists, except maybe Tom Flynn, who sit around in boardrooms plotting the next battle to steal presents and Christmas trees from the good little Christian children. The idea is absurd. We laugh at it. But, as for billboards, I haven't heard much this year. They're, a creative way to reach out and get a lot of attention. And I think the group in Kamloops was looking to put a version of the Freedom From Religion Foundation's ad in the local paper saying Jesus is a myth or whatever. But I'm not sure if they'll get it in press for the holidays. There is a case in Saskatoon, though, recently, where the man, Ashu Solo, I believe, who filed a human rights complaint a few months ago against his city opening meetings with prayers, he's now going after the local transit authority for putting Merry Christmas on city buses. I sort of posted this on Facebook and got a very mixed reaction from atheists. I think most people don't really see this as a battle worth fighting. And, you know, I can understand his sort of frustration and, you know, wanting to have a more inclusive message put out there. But it is one of those sort of small offenses that do we really want to fall on our sword on this issue? So maybe the best tactic, though, would have been to request a more inclusive message like Happy Holidays rather than, you know, threatening to sue and demanding apologies.
Is sort of related to this, and this is one area that can be kind of confusing, is that at what point does a religious practice become sort of a secular tradition? I mean, for example, the Lutheran Church in Sweden or even the Anglican Church in England to a degree are more social clubs than religious institutions. I mean, I've had discussions with listeners who think that things like, I don't know, Christmas carols at schools, you know, like a Silent Night or whatever, those that have sort of a religious message, should be still okay because it's part of our tradition. Thoughts?
Yeah, we see a lot of Europe is moving to secularize their culture. Norway actually recently disestablished its state religion, the Lutheran Church, with unanimous political support, including from the Christian Democrats. So, I mean, they're becoming more secular, but they're also sort of recognizing that even though these institutions may be ostensibly secular, they still sort of need to be divorced from their positions of privilege. And, you know, Christmas carols are a really tricky thing. There's clear black and white cases. For example, I received an email from a teacher in Abbotsford who informed me that his public school is planning to host their annual caroling at a local church. And the church even stipulated the songs the kids sing must be overtly religious. So I think this is a clear not secular activity and hence violates the BC School Act. But there's other cases where, you know, kids voluntarily participate to sing songs about Santa, Rudolph, and Frosty, which may or may not be as bad, you know. People may be fine with that. I did these things in my elementary school, and the only time I really felt uncomfortable is when we got to songs about baby Jesus. So it's a debate worth having, and I think as more families start to celebrate different holidays or, you know, new traditions, our communal institutions are going to have to adapt and find ways to include everyone and not push people out.
Yeah, I think it may be an exception, but I like that idea of sort of the reverse intolerance is where, you know, schools are expected to have religious songs, perhaps, but this one church was like, no, no, you can't have anything that isn't religious in it. That's kind of an interesting double standard on the right that often occurs. Thanks again for joining us, and do you have any last words for audience?
Well, as one atheist said to me in a gift I got the other day, let's just wish one another a happy Chris Kwanzaa.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah, I had to write it down.
Well, thank you, and we'll be right back after this break.
What is secular humanism?
Critical thinking.
Knowledge is freedom. Freedom from ignorance and its offspring, fear.
The BC Humanist Association has been active in the Vancouver area for over 25 years. We offer a friendly and welcoming place to make new friends, as well as free educational lectures. We invite you to join us any Sunday at 10 a.m. in the Oak Ridge Senior Center. Please visit our website for more details, bchumanist.ca.
Okay, that's all we have time for this week. I'm going to close on a bit of a more musical spirit than I normally do with a bunch of wonderful Christmas songs. Actually, stuff I've picked out that's a little bizarre and not your typical Christmas cheery sort of ones. I hope you enjoy it. This is Don saying happy holidays, Merry Christmas, but most of all, eyes open, minds on.
Tectonic plates, they shift around and change the boundaries. Where once were oceans, now there's ground and mountains now are sea. T'was plate that made the Atlantic rich and plate the land revolved, creating and destroying bridges. Plates changed how life life evolved. The weapons meet with great friction can cause unstable zones. Life may have never first begun from so.
inside. They have more organelles, especially nuclei. These organelles evolved as bacterial parasites, were gobbled up by ancient cells and began to thrive inside. Oh, single cell.
Oh, chemistry, oh, chemistry. apple pie from scratch. You must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.